Since 2013, the Pell Center at Salve Regina University has announced the story of the year, the narrative that had the biggest impact on American public life in the preceding 12 months. Today, we're joined by a thought leader whose work in and out of government gives her special insight into this year's top story. She's Evelyn Farkas this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello, and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me, as always, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that a lot of different ways, including the annual selection of a story of the year, the narrative that has most shaped public debate in the United States. Joining us to talk about the stories that shaped 2017 is a great friend. Dr. Evelyn Farkas is a senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a national security contributor to NBC News, who previously served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia in the Obama administration. Evelyn, thank you so much for being
with us.
Thanks
for having me, Jim.
So there are a lot of stories we could talk about, and we'll see where this conversation takes us. But one of the stories that seems obvious to me over the course of 2017 is this Bannonism, right?
Yeah.
This idea that we're going to tear down government. And both an agenda and a set of stories that were told about the effectiveness and the purpose of government that have played out over the course of 2017. What's your take on that story in the context of the last year?
So that story is a negative story. It's sort of a nihilist story, meaning, you know, take apart government inside America, so shrink it. The most graphic, I think, example of this is the State Department, but certainly there are similar designs against the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other agencies. That's the domestic side component of it. Then there's the international. Let's have the United States recede from overseas. Of course, part of this is also cutting the State Department and our diplomatic efforts overseas. But it's very negative. There's nothing positive. There's no statement about what America stands for or what we're going to do. It's all about what we're not going to do. We're going to be smaller. We're not going to do as much internationally, et cetera.
And it seems predicated on an idea domestically that government is part of the problem.
Right.
And internationally, that the United States doesn't have a constructive role to play, that the world can go off and do its own thing without an American hand on the tiller, so to speak.
Right. In a way, it's a kind of a negative assessment of America's leadership. It's saying the world is better off and America's better off if we kind of stay out of the game. Not only do we not lead, but we sort of recede. We're sort of absent. We have no friends. You see it really starkly when you see President Trump, you know, with his colleagues, you know, with his peers, foreign leaders, and he seems very alone. America's also kind of alone. And then, of course, internally, there's also, as I said, you know, the negative aspect of it.
So a question I would have is, when you get past Bannon and the president, who obviously are advocates of this philosophy, there are a lot of people who embrace that, a lot of ordinary Americans. Why? What is the appeal to the ordinary American?
I don't know. And there's another aspect I want to, which might help kind of elucidate why this is somehow appealing to the ordinary American. There's a very strong anti-intellectual, anti-science component of all of this, because the swamp that they refer to, they're people like me. You know, I live in the swamp. I have been a longtime participant, active member of the swamp for about 20 years. And I got to the swamp because I went to university too long, too much, maybe you could argue. But, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to get smart about international relations to become an expert so that I can work in our government and make sure that we have the best foreign policy and defense policy possible, right? But the Bannonism, even though he's got all these fancy degrees himself, what he and Trump have been peddling is sort of an anti-intellectual and then anti-science, and that's most extreme when we talk about climate change.
Does that have a regional component? I mean, is that philosophy or that belief stronger in different parts of the country compared to other parts of the country?
I think what you're getting at there is the people who are left behind. So The regional component, yes, because climate change, if you think that it's hurting, let's say, coal miners and coal territory and old America, the Rust Belt, if you will, then you're going to want to block out the science of it and just appeal. It's very populist. You know, it's not that this is very new. We've seen populism before, of course, most alarmingly and strikingly in the 30s before the rise of Adolf Hitler in Europe. And predominantly, of course, most markedly in Germany, but it wasn't just restricted to Germany. And now today also we see populism resurgent across the world. We see it in the Philippines, we see it in Europe, East and West. And one strong component of it has always been this appeal to the emotional, the appeal to the nihilist desire to throw out the experts, throw out science, because it's about the very base fears that people have, that they somehow don't belong anymore, that this isn't their America, that the economic, the trade arguments that the experts were using don't work for the average American or don't work for them, you know, this kind of American.
Isn't that a very self-centered attitude to have? I mean, it dispenses entirely with the notion of the common good.
Yes, and I think it's very interesting because you see it in areas where people profess to be deeply religious, yet it's not a kind of Franciscan Catholic, let's help the poor and, you know, less fortunate among us.
It's kind of a Teresa, for sure.
No, it's kind of a, well, you know, we need to take care of ourselves, I guess. And that, again, translates globally.
You know, in 2016, the story in the public square story of the year was nativism, the rise of nativism and populism in Western politics. But I want to come back to this question about why these types of narratives endure. There's been a fundamental shift in the information environment within which American politically informed news consumers get their information. Part of it's the rise of Fox News and I guess we could call it alternative media on the right. How much damage are these types of how much damage is this information environment doing to our ability as a nation, for example, to agree on the centrality of an issue that may or may not need action, but to agree on a fact pattern? You mentioned climate change. You know, there's some correlation between where you get your news from and what you think about climate change. How is that shaping the persistence of these stories and the way we think about issues broadly in America?
I don't think the problem is that we have a proliferation of outlets. You know, I could have my own, and pretty soon we're going to have, you know, everyone having their own TV station or their FaceTime station, right, potentially. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the erosion in standards. You know, now it's become acceptable for journalists to insert their opinion, and it's become hard to ascertain, you know, what is a real kind of normal journalistic, as neutral as possible outlet versus one where there's opinion. Most of the major networks, and I mean, I work for one of them, have programs. So the network will change according to, say, the time of day. So they'll have programming in the morning that's more opinion oriented. Then during the day, it's more kind of standard news and discussion. And then in the evening, it goes back to a little bit more opinion format. And that's the case for, I think, all the major networks. That makes it hard for Americans probably to differentiate what's actually real, what's been vetted through various journalistic
what's news means. And what's opinion.
Right. There's no editorial board. The editorial board function is a little bit more loosey-goosey, certainly with the television networks. I think with print, it's less so, but then there's the internet where they're not even printing anything anymore. It's just going straight to internet. And there, I think we've seen a real slippage in standards.
And of course, then you bring in social media, which is a big component of the internet, and you have people, to use that sort of stereotype term, in their silos. Mm-hmm. They know where they can go for what they want to believe. It just reinforces their beliefs. And, you know, and again, it just seems to be, you know, an erosion of sort of intellectual freedom or even curiosity, which I find, and many people find, disturbing. I want to turn to another major topic toward the end of the year, and that is the Me Too movement,
right,
which began with the New York Times and the New Yorker writing about Harvey Weinstein, who I think we all could agree is an egregious example.
Pretty bad hombre.
Yes, thank you. I was struggling for words that I could actually use on a TV program.
Yeah.
But that opened the floodgates, almost literally, to and what is still a daily unfolding story. Talk about that. I mean, this is one of the very, very powerful stories of this year and movements, and good that it is, yeah. by the way.
Yeah, I think it's a real awakening because a lot of women have realized that they just sort of accepted as normal what was sexual harassment right. in the workplace. And I think that is something also I have to step back and sort of make a point about, because these stories have really centered on the most alarming ones and the ones that came out first. You mentioned Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
These focused on workplace harassment. So it's the use of power, exercise of power, sort of sexual predatorship over female subordinates that men have exercised. And that's something that in certain industries has certainly been more of a problem than in others, but it's across the board a problem everywhere. And I think women for far too long have just put up with it. And so the Me Too movement has been really extraordinary in that not only have women felt really empowered to speak up, they also have been empowered because men have been willing to take action against the other, you know, bad hombres, if you will.
Do you think this movement is beginning to percolate down to the quote-unquote ordinary workplace? We're not talking Hollywood now, we're not talking politics, but just the ordinary workplace.
I think
so. The real estate agency, the bank, the marketing firm, you know, you name the hospitality industry, of course.
Right. To some extent, yes. I mean, I work in a think tank, and the head of the think tank put out a statement saying, you know, we don't tolerate any kind of sexual harassment in the workplace, and here's how you report it, here's what you should do. So there's that kind of communication now going on. Whether it translates into real cultural change remains to be seen. But the other aspect of it, and this is the part that I think we need to focus on next, is sexism. So there's sexual harassment in the society, and then of course in the workplace where this is really a problem that we're now focusing on. But there's another concurrent problem which is more prevalent than sexual harassment, and that's sexism in the workplace. And we still have that problem. And I worry that the focus on sexual harassment, if it's not handled properly, it could actually exacerbate the problems we have with sexism. And I'll just give you one quick example. Mm. As a female working on Capitol Hill, for example, if you are a senior staffer and you have the authority to travel, you want to travel with your boss. But some members of Congress have either written or unwritten policies where they will not travel with another woman, especially not an attractive woman, because of the veneer of impropriety, even the kind of appearance of potential impropriety.
Potential.
Right. And that's very bad for a woman if she's trying to get ahead in her career. She wants the proximity to the powerful boss, because if the boss gets to know her, he in this case would promote her. Also, if she's the duty expert on a certain subject matter, let's say it's counterterrorism, she should be able to go with the boss to Afghanistan, for example, on a counterterrorism trip and further her expertise. So I do worry a little bit about a negative boomerang.
And then, of course, there's sexism out of the workplace in marriages, in relationships,
sure.
partnerships, and just ordinary daily life,
which
I think is you know, sort of a tip of an iceberg, as it were.
And I should say, women aren't entirely sort of impervious to sexism themselves. I mean, oftentimes I'll have to catch myself if I walk into a room, you know, I shouldn't make assumptions about who is the boss, right?
Yeah, good point.
So I want to ask you a question about what's happened on nonproliferation in North Korea and Iran this year.
Yeah. The
Obama administration got a deal with Iran that experts, international experts, generally lauded for essentially freezing Iran's nuclear ambitions in place for a decade.
Right.
The Trump administration came in and they told a different story, that this was a terrible deal, that it was bad for American national security. Where do you come down on the truth of that, and how does that tie into the challenge that's arising from North Korea right now?
So first of all, I would say on the Iran deal, while it's not a perfect deal, I would agree with the experts that 10 years of freezing it is a great first step. I actually don't disagree with President Trump's idea of building on that. You know, the idea in and of itself is fine. The problem is with the execution, because he very unilaterally said he's going to walk away from it without coordinating with our allies and partners, you know, with the other signatories. And, of course, also, you know, did in doing so only encourage the Iranians to, you know, take full advantage of our administration policy. The North Korea problem is a problem because, unfortunately, the last administration, the Obama administration, which I was part of, didn't really do anything to slow down North Korea's program. And there may have been, indeed, some kind of intelligence failure in terms of a lack of understanding of how long it was going to take the North Koreans. And perhaps there's a third-party country helping
North
Korea.
How long it would take them to achieve ICBM capacity.
Right. So to get a nuclear-tipped missile that was capable of hitting the mainland in the United States. Now, they're still not there yet.
Right.
I think it's important that the public understands that they're still not there yet. But they could be there within a year or so, the experts say, because what they've tested so far was essentially kind of a dummy missile, a missile that tested how far it could go, that the trajectory was right, but it didn't have a weapon, thank God. It
payload.
Wasn't armed with a payload or anything that was as heavy as a payload would be.
So we're going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard three times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, 124. Story in the Public Square is produced each week by a wonderfully talented crew at Rhode Island PBS, and Wayne and I can't thank them enough. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. My co-host is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. G. Wayne Miller is on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Dr. Evelyn Farkas, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia in the Obama administration. Now she's Senior Fellow at the Atlanta Council and a National Security Contributor to NBC News. She's on Twitter, at Evelyn N. Farkas. Now, this is the moment we've been building to, the announcement of the 2017 story of the year, Trump-Russia. In the first week of January 2017, the U.S. intelligence community briefed both President Obama and then President-elect Trump on what was known about Russia's effort to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The story has dogged President Trump since then, with an FBI counterintelligence investigation being replaced by a special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, after President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, by his own admission, because of, quote, this Russia thing. Now, as we near the end of the calendar year, this Russia thing has already led to multiple indictments and two guilty pleas, including the president's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. It also led to a lot of suspicion that the president's inner circle, including his children, may have coordinated their efforts with a Russian government that favored candidate Trump over his rival. There are counter-narratives, too, pushed by this president and his surrogates, that the Russia story is an excuse by Democrats trying to explain away a historic election loss, that all this investigation has not yet led to, quote, collusion. And now the counter-narrative has taken an ominous turn, and the president and his allies are asserting that Robert Mueller's team is corrupt, like the entire FBI, they allege, seeming to set the stage for, at minimum, a political showdown over any future revelations about the president's knowledge or involvement in this Russia thing, as he put it, and at maximum, a full-blown constitutional crisis. That's a lot to take in, but that's our story of the year for 2017. So, Evelyn, you've worked Russia, you've worked the issue for a long time. Where do you see this narrative fitting into the reality that you know about Russian foreign policy and their objectives in the world?
Right. Well, so the first thing you need to know about Russia is the Russian government, the Kremlin, Putin, and his cronies, they decided the U.S. was an adversarial state. You can date it back to maybe the beginning of the Iraq War, but for sure, when Putin got onto the podium at a big international security conference in Munich in 2007, he said, this has got to stop. We can't have a unilateral system, meaning the U.S. bossing the world around. And that was when he kind of laid the marker down. The next year, he invaded Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. We had said, we being NATO, had said, oh, Georgia will one day be a member. And then in 2014, he invaded Ukraine, which was another country that we had said could become a member of NATO eventually. There are a whole lot of other things that he did, and some of these things are coming to the fore. But basically, his goal is to stay in power. And to stay in power, what he's done is essentially, first he provided economic means for the Russians. But when the tide began to turn on the global stage and for him domestically on the economic front, he then said, okay, I'm going to switch horses and I'm going to provide nationalism to the people. I'm going to demonstrate that Russia's great again. And by the way, I'm also going to strike out on the international front and make sure that no international coalition can go in to rescue any people from their despotic, brutal dictator. And the best example, of course, is Syria, where he's done this. But what he has in the back of his mind is himself. What he fears most is a United States that's strong and can ultimately somehow engineer a change in Russia's government that will put him out of the job. And so I think that's important as a backdrop to all of this. That's why he saw an opportunity to attack our elections, and he did so.
Do you have any doubt about the fact that Russia intervened in the U.S. election in 2016?
Absolutely none. And in fact, that part, it surprises me that he took that risky move, but the fact that he would meddle in our democracy doesn't surprise me. When I watched inside the Pentagon in 2015, Black Lives Matter, the movement, I thought, you know, the Russians are going to figure out a way to exploit our real problems, our real grievances, by potentially putting money in and, you know, fueling the fire with information, et cetera. I mean, I kind of had a sense in my gut that I wouldn't have been surprised if the Russians were involved. It turns out, from what we've heard from Facebook, the Russians were putting racially tinged messages out on Facebook. They were taking advantage of our racial cleavages.
And targeting places like Maryland and Missouri, which had had racial riots
in
the years there before.
Are there any experts like yourself who have studied this authoritatively, scholastically, with knowledge and background, who disagree?
Not that I know of.
I mean, I certainly have not seen a single credible person.
Right.
You know, once you get back into the silos and you have people who are falling victim to Facebook ads and whatever, and of course that's a different discussion, but there seems to be no credible source, at least in this country.
I mean, some people say we need to see evidence of the collusion, but not that Russia actually attacked our elections with an information operation.
So how dangerous do you think is this new counter narrative that's emerged that sort of is questioning the integrity, the independence of the special prosecutor and his team, and essentially the FBI and the Justice Department?
It's really dangerous, and I see it as part and parcel of what you guys were asking me about earlier when we talked about the stories that didn't make it, because it's kind of related. There's an assault on experts, on the trusted institutions in America, media, the courts, the FBI, law enforcement. And I think that's really dangerous. Again, in addition to what we already talked about, the assault on knowledge and experts, scientists, et cetera. That makes it then very easy for Americans to say, oh, I'm going to ignore the facts because these people are somehow no longer credible. And ultimately it becomes an issue where information isn't credible. There are no facts anymore. And if you create a Russian-like situation inside the United States, the American people eventually will say, well, we don't even care what the truth is. We don't want to hear it.
So a question we ask when this topic comes up, and it has repeatedly this year, I mean, probably more than any other topic, and we've looked at a whole lot of them, what's the antidote to that? How do you fight back against that when people in growing numbers and many of them smart people just dismiss experts, don't believe it?
I think that people trust people they know, so this has to start really at the local level. People, even though they hate Congress, for example, they still like their representative, although,
point.
I would quibble with some of the representatives running around the Hill, nevertheless.
But people there are some exceptions to that.
They like their
that, yeah.
congressman, you know, their senator. So I think if people can be credible at a local level, that helps. Obviously, there are long-term things we need to do. We have a real deficiency, I believe, in civic knowledge. I was knocking on doors. You know, I'll confess I have my own political stripes. Obviously, I worked for Obama, so I'm a Democrat, and I volunteered for Hillary Clinton knocking on doors. And I remember one gentleman saying to me, well, I'm not worried about Trump because I know he doesn't have his finger on the nuclear button. Congress does. And I thought, well, we need to send him back to social studies, you know, because, I mean, that's a real fundamental misunderstanding of the power that the president has. Now I would imagine that individual is well aware, if he's watching TV, because of all the alarm people have about the powers that President Trump has. But I think we do need to do long-term better civic education at the elementary school level and the high school level, not waiting till college. But then in the interim, at the grassroots level, we need to have more trusted agents speaking out for the truth. I really believe that colleges and universities have a big role in this as well. Mm-hmm. And the media needs to be held to greater account. And I think people who have the power to fund the media should do so. And then again, hold them to higher standards.
What about the role of the individual? So we're all purveyors and consumers of news now. We all hit like, we hit tweet, we hit retweet and share.
Yeah.
What responsibility do we as American citizens have in the promulgation of some of these stories?
Well, I think we need to think twice before we forward something. But I think as an average citizen, it's also hard to know. You want to look at who's the source. So the Facebook people who are getting these fake news stories from the Russians, they should have looked to see who's the source. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's a lot of what they call clickbait. So these, you know, I don't know, Tiffany's not really the daughter of Donald Trump or something, and people click on it. But, you know, you should know that what you're clicking on is probably actual fake news,
right?
You know, because there is fake news. And so I think Facebook and the people who give us the outlet, you know, the gateway into the internet, those companies should also be held to account, because they're making a lot of money off of our clicks and our, you know, participation in their Facebook world and in their Google world, just to pick two. Twitter, I have a real beef with, because they have all these bots. You know, they're not even real people, and they spew a lot of hate towards me, and I'm sure each of you occasionally.
Well, Wayne, at least.
Yeah, and if it's a real person.
I deserve it. I was raised Roman Catholic, so I understand guilt and shame.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, if it's a real person, then at least you could try to reason with them. But if it's a bot, you know, it gives a false impression. Other people watching don't know. I try to say you're a bot, but I try to report it to Twitter. There's no actual thing you can click where you say, I think this is a bot, not a real person.
You know, we've got about 45 seconds left. Very quickly, the president, who keeps repeating that major established news organizations are fake news, seems to fit into it's part of this narrative, and it's part of the information environment that the Russians exploited and created in some respects. How does the American citizen make sense of that?
I think just education. We need to cover more. For example, what did Putin do in Russia? How did he take over the Russian media? What are the phrases he uses? Because this fake news, a lot of the phrases that Bannon and the alt-right uses, and that, of course, the president has adopted, they're the same kind of things that the Russians say. In fact, sometimes you can pick up your newspaper and hear literally the same phrase being used.
It's right out of the Putin playbook.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Evelyn Farkas, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's the 2017 Story of the Year. She's Evelyn Farkas with the Atlantic Council and NBC News. That's all the time we have this week. We want to thank all of the members of our audience for joining us wherever you are. We're grateful to spend this time with you. If you want to know more about the show or to catch up on past episodes, you can visit PellCenter.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. He's Wayne, I'm Jim, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time on Story in the Public Square.